I'm glad to be here. I hope you are. Fact is, I hope very much you will be in another hour, which is the real test of the matter. I'm speaking about the Dentsy's Cult because I was asked to. So if you don't like the subject, guess who asked me? You can deal with him after I've left town. I think it an important subject. Can't possibly deal with it in 40 minutes. It would be indecent not to have questions at the end. I must therefore try to control my involvement in detail as much as possible. I love the story of the woman who said, "My husband is even smarter than Einstein." "How so?" said the neighbor lady. "Ah," said the woman, "only 12 people in all the world understand Einstein. Nobody understands my husband." That may be about where you'll be in a few minutes. If so, it won't be because the subject is profound. It will be because the lecturer is inadequate, both to you and to the subject. Nonetheless, if there is any single defense, it is that I don't believe in teaching things in a theological seminary that can't be repeated in the church if the church wants to hear them. I think a great deal of the difficulty in many local churches these days is because a lot of clergy learn good things in seminary and let a 30-year lag happen between that and what was taught in the parish, and we've got to stop that. We are a biblical people. We are a seriously biblical people. That's our foundation. It's our strength. I'm not going on very long on that. I taught in Denver last summer at one of the Methodist seminaries. The day before I got there, a secretary put a sign on my desk. I still resent it. It said, "What God wants is spiritual fruit, not religious nuts." I keep wondering why she put that on my desk. Well, we'll see what you get today, but I have an intention, at least, to say some things. I want to divide what I wish to say this morning into four sections, if you please. I don't know that I need to spend a lot of time defining. We need some chairs. Here are a couple of fine chairs. Oh, there are back there. I just thought I'd call attention. In fact, you're coming in now. Is that all right? Good morning. That's gracious, and we appreciate it. I'd like to suggest what I want to do falls into four categories. The first thing I'd like to do is deal with a completely irrelevant fact. It's not at all unusual among teachers, except they seldom admit it, probably because they don't realize it. Second thing is, I'd like to tell you a story. There's the rub of the matter. Thirdly, I'd like to offer three reasons why I told you the story in the second place. And I hope that holds. And fourthly, we must open the floor to questions. If we don't get to that, I'll hang around in the narthex up there and you can throw things you didn't get to throw at this earlier time, if you are willing. Well, I grew up in Nebraska in a cornfield. We had a very definite theory of how we got the Bible. It ran something like this. That along about the middle of June in 50 A.D., on a warm day, there was an ungodly clap of thunder, the heavens opened up, and the original copy of the Bible in King James English came floating down out of the sky. A little shepherd boy who had gone to Polytech and was very well trained in early Elizabethan English looked at it, realized what he had, snapped it shut, ran and hid it in the nearest desert cave. And where I grew up, we knew that the original copy of the Bible in English was someplace in or near Jerusalem. And if we ever really got hard-pressed to find what Jesus really said, after all, he should know he wrote it. I'm sorry, I'm not making fun of my people. We repeated what we'd been taught, or let be known what we hadn't been taught. What we should have been told is that for 2,000 years from ancient times, around 100 campfires in the Middle East, people told stories, repeated myths, an adage, an axiom, a moral saying, a dream that they'd received from God, a vision, a story of a great battle, a story of a great love affair, poetry, so forth. Your grandparents knew more about this than you and I do because they believed in oral tradition. I'm a country boy. I grew up on a party line. I have an awful time with oral tradition. But deep down, I know that almost everything that's really valuable in the Bible came to us through oral tradition. Jesus of Nazareth apparently never wrote a blessed thing down. He trusted people like you and me to preserve and repeat. Around 1,000 campfires, and when people would travel back and forth from Beersheba to Jerusalem to Bethel, up to Nablus and up to Galilee, they'd hear things and they'd say, "Gee, I'd like to have a copy of that." And as time went by, this distilled into something close to a national literature. And by the time of the exile, somebody said, got no home, got no temple, got no city. How do we know we're a Jew? And somebody sang out one of the most beautiful words in the language of the human family. May I sing it? Torah, Torah. Let's take our traditions and put them on a scroll. Now I'm going to sell overalls in Salem, Oregon. I'm the only Jew in town. How do you know you're a Jew, kid? I got Torah under my arm. Want to make something out of it? And they became the people of the book. And because the holy name of God was written on that book, I'm still on the irrelevant fact, a name so holy it probably wasn't pronounced for 200 years before the time of Jesus, when a scroll began to wear out, they didn't just toss it in an unused Sunday school room behind a piano. They took it and wrapped it in clean linen, put it in a little box, buried it in the loft of the church or in the synagogue, or in the cemetery out next to Uncle Ezra. And in this process, can you hear me? We lost the original copy of every one of the books of the Old Testament. Now you may say, who wants to spend an hour talking about the Old Testament? I will remind you that the Old Testament was the Bible of Jesus and the early church. I will remind you that Jesus of Nazareth never called for the writing of any material beyond the Old Testament. I will remind you that Jesus had a terrible habit of almost never reading the New Testament. Worry about that if you will, please. I just want us to bear in mind that we lost the original copies of almost every one of the books of the Old Testament. And until the story that I'm going to tell you, here's the irrelevant fact. Until the story that I'm going to tell you happened, our oldest copies of any book of the Old Testament in Hebrew dated from about 1008 AD. Two copies. One was and still is in the Leningrad Museum. I told you this was irrelevant. And the other was in Syria, in Damascus, and is now on the campus of the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Let me tell you this irrelevant fact. Until the discovery I'm going to talk about happened, the oldest copies of any of the scrolls of the Old Testament, the Bible of Jesus in the early church, dated from 1000 AD, closer to us than Jesus, much closer to us than to the authors of the story. File that, will you? And if I never come back to it, be decent about it. But if I do, I'll make my point well. We've got now to move to the second part of this lecture, which is the story, if you please. I can't tell a story until I've got a place and until I have characters. Our story happens in a region south of Jerusalem. The characters of our story are a bunch of Arab nomads whose home base is Bethlehem, 6 miles south of Jerusalem, but who have sense enough to be nomads, keep ahead of the IRS, wander around through the desert. Then every December, November, January, when the wind and rain begins to come across the spiny high country of Palestine, these Bedouin head down for the Dead Sea, where they pitch their black goat's hair tents and wither it out from December to January, February, March. It's sort of the Miami Beach of ancient Semitic life. We don't need to go into that much further, I think. You either know what I'm talking about or you don't. The time is 1946, or was it 1947? All the scholars were busy doing second-rate things elsewhere. When these Beni Amran, the Bedouin tribes, came wandering down to set up their black goat's hair tents at the edge of the Dead Sea and winter it out.
Let me portray it for you. You're out in the Dead Sea. Don't worry if you can't swim. Just keep your head up and your feet down, and the salt will do the rest of the job. At the northwestern corner of the Dead Sea, are you still with me? The beach is very narrow. Look, you'll see the black goat's hair tents already. You must have thought they were flies from our helicopter, but no, those are goat tents. At that corner of the Dead Sea, a little rock promontory arises to a height of about 200 feet, has a flat area on top about 2 acres in extent. And up behind it, like some God-appointed amphitheater, in a circle, the Judean hills, 750, 800 feet high, the beginning of a desert that runs clear to the Mediterranean. Are you with me? The Bedouin. January 1947. January 1947. This is a well-organized chauvinistic society. If there's any work to do, the women will do it. The men have been resting all day, and they'd like to rest all night. But they are a shepherding community, and they are in a subtropical region where there are wild animals. And so, just before they roll over to continue their resting, the elders of the tribe say to some of the young bucks, "Bring in the sheep. Set the dogs around them." I happen to know one of those young bucks. He's now managing an apartment house in Bethlehem. His name is Muhammad El-Dib, Muhammad the Wolf. We were told to bring in the sheep. We looked around and realized that not all the sheep were there. Went up onto this little plateau, didn't discover them. Necessity is often the mother of observation. Realized for the first time that up in those Judean hills, there were pocked out caves. Shinnied up to one of them. Had sense enough not to go into an unexplored desert cave. Instead of shinnying in, threw in a rock. Instead of hearing the bleating of a kid, December 1946, they heard the resounding crash of pottery. Even the untutored in the Middle East seem to have an uncanny sense of the potential commercial value of archaeology. How many scrolls, if any, they found there? What the Bedouin found in that cave? Qumran, number one? Nobody knows. Several years later, when competent archaeologists came, they found the cave littered with cigarette butts. We do not think these were left either by the Romans or the early Christians. What have we here? The world doesn't know anything about this. Some of you know that there was trouble in the area. There always is. Presumably, the Bedouin discovered a number of other caves, but the outside world doesn't know very much about it. But hang on, would you please? March 1948, early in the morning, two Bedouin boys, one of them with a gunny sack. Does that word mean anything to any of you? A burlap bag over his shoulder, walking across the square in front of the Church of Nativity in Jerusalem, heading for the shop of a shoe merchant whose name is Can Do. Every town needs somebody named Can Do, no matter what you need done. And the Bedouin boys, Can Do, incidentally, has done rather well lately and runs a chain of jewelry shops in Jerusalem, or has until very lately. The Bedouin boys went into the shop of Can Do, and he said, "What do you want?" And I must pause for a moment, because they didn't really know what they wanted. They put that burlap bag down on that scruffy old shoe salesman's counter. And out of that bag, they pulled 11 scrolls. And you must understand, back in the medieval ages when I went to seminary, if anybody should ever have said, "We will find one scroll from the time of Jesus in Palestine," he'd been laughed out of Boston. But look at it, 11 scrolls, written in Hebrew, Aramaic, Greek, typically parchment, skin, typically 11.5 inches high, typically handwritten. One of those scrolls, 125 feet long. Two nearly complete copies of the prophetic book of Isaiah. That's something, because Isaiah runs to 66 chapters. A commentary on Genesis we had never seen before. A book for rules of people who formed up as battalions fighting for the Lord we'd never seen. A collection of psalms. No one of them the same as the 150 we have before David broke his pen. Good heavens, did he have a second pen? I don't know. Think about that, would you? A beautiful book, a book of rules for a community living in the desert. Miller Burroughs of Yale, who was in Jerusalem at the time when they brought those scrolls in, said he'd heard of a church in America that was governed by a book called The Discipline. And he named that scroll The Manual of Discipline. One of the best things that happened to Methodists in the 20th century. And we had nothing to do with it. What have we here? The Bedouin boy said to Can Do, "Will you take these up to Jerusalem and sell them?" Can Do didn't know what he had. He couldn't read Hebrew and Aramaic either. But it was a potential commercial investment possibility. He went up to Jerusalem. War was about to break out between the Arabs and the Israelis, May 1948, that hideous tragedy that still is perpetuated. Went first to a Syrian Orthodox monastery, met a guy by the name of Archbishop Samuel who couldn't read the Hebrew or the Greek either and sold 5 of the scrolls to Archbishop Samuel. Hang on to that. There are a few details now. You may get bored stiff. I'll try to hurry. Went next door to Professor Sukenik of the Hebrew University, the father of Yigal Yadin, whom some of you know as a former associate prime minister of Israel, sold the other 6. War broke out. Archbishop Samuel had to leave. He came to the United States, brought the 5 scrolls and a little black bag, showed them in Boston, Chicago, New York, and deposited them in that proper place for all holy manuscripts, the Chase Manhattan Vault. And there in New York City, I'm sorry, the line between the secular and the sacred is very wobbly. And there, from 1948 to 1952, in a Chase Manhattan Bank vault, those 5 scrolls were deposited. Archbishop Samuel was translated from being a priest in Jerusalem to being a curate in Hackensack, New Jersey. Again, the sacred and the secular is just a little wobbly, in my judgment. In 1952, there appeared in that great biblical publication called the Wall Street Journal a little 4-line ad saying, "Biblical manuscripts of great antiquity for sale." Lawyers from the state of Israel went to Hackensack incognito, Archbishop Samuel was an Arab, and bought those 5 scrolls. I don't know whether they got the little black bag or not. Regrettably, Archbishop Samuel didn't report it to the IRS, and there has within the last 2 years been a serious case in the Federal District Court of Boston. But this is my long-winded way of saying that all the scrolls found in Qumran Cave Number 1, say it with me, please, Qumran Cave 1, are now back in a building on the campus of the Hebrew University called the House of the Book. For many people, this is the story of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and in a few minutes, you will wish it were. But I got news for you. It's only the beginning. Aren't you glad there's a deadline? As soon as peace had been drawn up between the Arabs and the Israelis in 1949, the king of Jordan, ruling from Amman, the same place as is called Ammon in the Bible, declared martial law around the northern half of the Dead Sea. He went and got 2 competent archaeologists, a fine old Englishman by the name of Lancaster Harding, who was head of antiquities in Jordan, and a Roman Catholic priest by the name of Roland de Beau, who had been rattling around Jerusalem since shortly after creation, and asked them to carry out a series of excavations around the northern half of the Dead Sea. And I'd like to have you itch a little bit. You know, there's a lot of sentimentality about archaeology. But archaeology in the Jordan Valley in August is like digging post holes in western Kansas in the same period. Archaeology comes a lot easier in a air-conditioned library than it does out on the field. So won't you itch a little when I tell you that DeVoe and Harding carried on 6 campaigns? And you must let me have my little ballet moment now when I say to you, they rediscovered Qumran Cave Number 1. They found the cigarette butts. That's a great moment in history, huh? And then they found, are you still there? Qumran Cave Number 2, 3, 4. Will you remember it? Right here, the only one up on top of this little plinth. Watch that one. 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 11 caves with something like a library of manuscripts in every one of them. Where the people have been saying for 1,000 years, you'll never find anything in Palestine like the manuscripts of ancient Egypt or Mesopotamia. You know, dummies. Let's look at it for a moment. As they found these caves, Père Devaux, a wonderful Roman Catholic priest, began to notice that with the exception of Qumran Cave Number 4, these caves were all located in a kind of semicircle up there in the hills, and that this place was bare. He had sense enough to do what you and I would do, and that is to begin to scratch around up on this little 2-acre plateau. Do you remember the geology? You're still swimming. Here's the beach, here's this little shelf, and then the amphitheater. So they began to dig here. And the first day, they discovered a field stone wall 8 feet thick and 15 feet into the ground, the corner of a building. Now, a Bedouin and his wife dragging a camel across the desert don't build that kind of overnight lodgings, even if she's a AAA traveler. You just cannot do it, you know. What have we here? Come inside that wall with me, and I will show you a pantry in which DeVoe and Harding discovered within a couple of days more than 1,000 pots and jars and cooking utensils. I've spent 11 years of my life in the Middle East, 10 of them around the pyramids at Giza. And on Saturday afternoons, the first 5 years I was there, I was a bachelor, I would walk around on the edge of the Sahara, and I got into the habit of walking with heavy heels. I was going to make the great archaeological discovery. Can't you hear it? Once in 10 years, my heel hit a thud, and I reached down and scratched the sand and discovered a jar handle. British. Guinness. 1947. It did not make my career. 1,000 jars and pots in one place in a couple of days. Come with me and I will show you a dining hall 72 feet long up on this little plateau. If you don't believe me, all you got to do is buy a ticket and go and see. A dining hall 72 feet long. And down at the end of them, a kind of a podium where an ill-fated brother might have to eat and read while other people ate their locusts and honey or whatever they had there in common and in silence. Take off your shoes and come with me next door. I will show you next to that dining room one of the shrines of Western civilization. The scholars call it the scriptorium. It's the copying room. It's where they put scrolls together and copied them. From that little room, we have got benches, desks finished off in hard-baked clay, metal ink pens, ink pots, scrolls. Do you begin to hear it? Those of you who have Baptist propensities, and I hope that's all of you, should know that up on this little rock place, they've carved out 12 cisterns from the living rock, and most of them with a staircase so you could go down to wherever the water level was, and an ingenious Gibraltar-like system for draining the water off the Judean hills through a channel which you can still walk down to those cisterns. Over here, a row of rooms, little cells where a person could read or study or do whatever a monk does when he's monkeying around, I do not know. Just outside that wall and still up on the plateau, DeVoe and Harding discovered more than 1,000 graves. And you've got to stay in a place for a little while to have 1,000 graves. You don't have to stay very long to have 1,000 casualties. You have to stay a while to have 1,000 graves. And what do you do with the fact, A, that everybody is buried like everybody else in a simple white shroud? What do you do with the fact that they're almost exclusively the corpses of men and little boys? Oh, we'll come back to that if we have time. Please. DeVoe and Harding discovered down here at the end of this place a flax weaving plant, and next to it, a place where they made pottery. Big jars with ears on them. We've got one at the school that Lanny and I have graduated from. Come see it. It's beautiful. What is this? What have we here? The question was being asked. A site. Obviously, people lived here. We've never heard of them. Up behind the amphitheater, the caves, their library. And then Père DeVoe, that great Roman Catholic scholar, remembered that one of the scrolls that they had discovered, which he had named the Manual of Discipline, was a book of rules for a group of people living in the desert. And now I'm going to conjecture a little, but I'd like to comfort you by saying you're not about to be victimized. That what I want to posit now has been supported by scholars, Catholic, Jewish, Protestant, secular, more than 99% of them. What we had here is a group of Jews who turned their back on Jerusalem because it was impure. Or talk about a Jew who turned his back on Jerusalem because it was impure. It's like talking about a Roman Catholic who won't receive the Blessed Sacrament at the high altar of St. Peter's in Rome. Where else are you going? And yet there were those, weren't there, who said, prepare ye in the desert, not in Jerusalem. Prepare ye in the desert, a highway for our God. We read the Manual of Discipline. We discovered there was a community of people down here with a teacher, maybe two teachers, ruled by a council of 12. Don't get excited about that. That's typical rabbinic pattern. But when you came to join this community, a monastery in the desert, the first thing they asked you, will you turn over your property on a non-refundable basis? And that separated the men from the boys. And that reminds some of us of the book of Acts. And you can hear it, can't you? And then there were, and if you decided you'd become a member of this community, you were to be a novice for a year, and they examined you. And if you passed the examination, you were to be a novice for a second year. And if you passed that examination, you became a member of the community. But, says the Manual of Discipline, just because somebody's a member of the community, do not treat him or her in a special way. If they walk sideways, speak to them. They do not listen, two of you speak to them. They do not listen, bring them up into the presence of the community. They do not listen, throw them out as though they were tax collectors and publicans. Sound familiar? It is repeated verbatim in the 18th chapter of the Gospel according to St. Matthew. A group of Jews who had come to live in the desert because they were singing out that they were living in the latter days. For those of you who like to have biblical texts for an address, I can give you a really good one. The motto of this community is the third verse of the 40th chapter of Isaiah. May I sing it? I don't know what this singing I'm doing this morning. Because in the great liturgical communities, we don't just say things, we chant. Huh? Prepare ye in the desert a highway for our God. If that sounds familiar to you, it is because it appears someplace in the first, second, or third chapters of every one of the four Gospels. I want you to get it. We are dealing with some common roots here, some common love, some common concern that's deep. Prepare ye in the desert a highway for our God. And so groups of people came out and they lived quietly. This was perhaps one of several monasteries. We do not know. It would appear that there was a time when the work of God was so urgent that marriage became secondary. If you've read Jeremiah, you can understand that. If you've read Jesus, you can understand that. If you've read Paul, they never promulgated a doctrine of celibacy. They simply said, for the moment, the work of God is so urgent. And so you find in the cemetery men and little boys who may not have made it in the demands of the death. Isn't it interesting how easily we read texts? The New Testament says, John the Baptist was in the desert from the time he was a little child. Will you tell me about the little boy who makes it in the desert alone? You know, pack up the Wheaties, Mama. I'm heading east. Ridiculous. I can't say John the Baptist was in this community, but I can say the early Christian movement began by people singing, prepare ye in the desert a highway for our God. We're living in the new times. Every Friday afternoon at Qumran, they formed up battalions to fight the enemy of the Lord whom they were to hate with a perfect hatred. I'm not glossing over differences. Life went on in Qumran. Incidentally, there was a flat rule in Qumran that if ever you got attacked, you were not supposed to recant the faith because as good Pharisees, you believed in immortality and you would rather die than to recant what you had said you believed. A point which is to be taken with utmost seriousness. We know that there was community life here. From about 150 BC, that there was life here right across the time of the death of Herod the Great in 4 BC. And we know that there was life here down to about 70 AD. It is perfectly clear then that there was a life of Qumran right across the historic life of Jesus of Nazareth. Whatever happened to the community at Qumran, mind you, I'm trying to summarize so we can get on to the third point. This is not a long lecture, it just seems long, all right? Whatever happened to the brothers at Qumran, I think that is a question that must be at least attempted in our dealing with it, and which we must try to give some kind of answer, though I must admit to you that halfway through this next point, I will drop truth and indulge in impure, adulterated Beck. I think it's right, but I can't prove it. There was life across Qumran. There was an earthquake in 31 BC that shook down almost everything in the Middle East, including many of the cisterns and walkways at Qumran. The brothers of Qumran were away for 25 years, something like that. When they came back, they repaired those waterways. We can see the repair in the staircases and so forth. We think they were here at the time, as I said before, of the death of Herod the Great and continued down to about 70 or 72 or 3 of our era, right across the early chapters of Christianity. What happened to Qumran? Let me try to answer that. Most of you know that about 70 of this era, No, that's not correct. 66 of this era, The Romans got sick and tired of trying to put up with what is called in Roman documents the damned Jew. It had been part of the Roman Empire. The emperor handed it to the Senate. The Senate passed it back. Nobody wanted this place where seven nations tried to live together and fought. And finally, an emperor of Rome decided he was going to annihilate the Jewish community. And he sent his firstborn son as chief of the imperial general staff to Jerusalem. And it took a long time. In the end of 2 years, there were casualties, Josephus says, of 100,000 on either side. Those are probably exaggerated figures, but it was a tragedy. Titus was called home to be emperor of Rome. So badly did he want to win against this little colony, he sent his firstborn son to finish the job. And in 70 AD, according to tradition, are you still with me? The Romans destroyed Jerusalem. There is a statement in some documents that